Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Hey, this is Tyler.
And this is KC.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. There'll be no snow. It'll be warm, though. What else?
The white weatherman is here. It's the most hottest time of the year.
Oh, man.
Most hottest. That's good English.
I like it. Yeah. I like it. We don't speak a whole lot of English on this podcast, so that's all right. Oh, yep. Man. I'm sorry we hadn't been making a lot of contact with you guys lately, but we've been super busy. I mean, granted, it is the first week of November, so if you're not super busy hunting, you might should get that way. We have Rod White on the podcast today, one of KC's just favorite guys we've ever had on. His actually goes by Rodriguez sometimes.
Yeah, Rodriguez right? White, yeah. I believe this is the long version.
Blanco, yeah, that's right.
No, I like Rod, dude. He's freaking, he knows his stuff.
He's
done a lot of cool stuff. He's done a lot of hunting and has structured his life that way.
Yeah.
And whether you can relate or not to being able to, like, hunt for half your life is doesn't really matter. You can learn a lot from somebody who has.
Oh, yeah.
Either way. You know, like, if you're a guy who only gets to hunt 2 weeks a year, then maybe listen to somebody who gets to hunt way more than that, you know?
Yeah, maximize your two weeks, you know?
Absolutely.
Dude, for sure. Every time we talk to Rod, I learn something, it seems like. Rod has done – he's spent a lot of time around captivity deer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Captive deer.
Yeah, I believe his ex-father-in-law is one of the guys who does deer sense, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So he's just seen deer act and behave and do things most of us haven't. Not to mention, I mean, how long has he lived in Iowa?
Long time.
Dude, you get to experience some things there, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deer doing what they do, like, uninhibited a lot of times.
And he travels everywhere and does a lot of deer hunting, too. And I think that one of the cool things about Rod is that he makes every effort to be out in the woods and then kind of chronicle what deer are doing on certain times. I mean, he's going to talk about 3 or 4 day windows that are on the calendar that you need to pay attention to, you know, if you're hunting deer in the upper Midwest, which if you're not, there's still a lot of value in this. You just need to make sure you can shift your dates a little bit and understand that, you know, the further south you go, kind of the way things change up or whatever, but deer is still going to do deer stuff throughout the year.
For sure, dude. Yeah, I think, you know, the some of the dates as a person that's not in the South, some of the dates or that hunts out of the South, I guess, some of the dates that he talks about are coming up quick. So
quickly this
listen
week,
to this thing, get in your brain.
And they also line up with a really good cold front.
Man, which is coming, and we're just waiting on it. It's just hot air sitting on top of us right now.
Yes, it's so hot. But, guys, real quick, if you have not done this, I know a lot of you are pretty new listeners, and we appreciate you being here. And we want you to stick around, but we want you to bring your friends with you. So tell your friends about the podcast. And if you haven't yet, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on iTunes if you haven't done that. Or if you're listening on one of the other podcast platforms, also reviews help a lot there too. Five stars only, though. That's all we take. The other ones won't work.
Well, yeah, that's the thing is I've tried to give us a 2-star and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
It's weird. Yeah. You have to put a 5-star in, but you know, you can say whatever you want to in the comment. So with that, we also are getting real close to 10,000 subs on YouTube. So also tell your friends to go follow us or subscribe on YouTube, that is. And that's once we get to that 10,000 mark, we might have to do a giveaway or something.
Yeah.
I know some people that might give us some cool gear to give away.
Way cooler than things we've done in the past. We've done some cool stuff in the past, don't get me wrong. But like, I remember also, like, when we first got started, we gave away a Sitka hat, which is not the worst thing.
Yeah.
But there's better things.
People aren't knocking at the door for a Sitka hat.
No, they aren't.
But yeah, free stuff is cool, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we've come a long way. You got to start somewhere with humble beginnings.
That's right, man.
But we would appreciate that a lot, and we'll try to do a giveaway across different platforms. So reviews might be a thing that get giveaway stuff. Mm-hmm. So go ahead and give us a review here on the podcast. We appreciate that. If you need help, send us an email or a message on Instagram or Facebook, and we'll help you get through that process. Sometimes it's weird.
Don't make it like super timely, because if you're like, hey, I got a buck in the field of what I do, we probably can't get to you right then. Sorry. Yeah. But we do our best to get all those messages within a couple days. And thank y'all for actually caring what we have to think about things. I don't know if that is actually worth anything or not, but we appreciate you asking either way.
Well, we've been out for quite a while right now, and we've been working really hard. I mean, it's just, you know, before the sun comes up to way after the sun comes down, either hunting or working on things that have to do with hunting a lot of times, or trying to keep our family in, upheld, I guess, while we're away. And it's been so much work that I think it's compromised my immune system a touch. I had a fever last night, and I'm not sure I don't have one right now. I was, had just chills and stuff, you know. I hadn't really seen anybody too much, you know. So, I mean, seen a few people, but figured I would have had something before last night if I was going to get it. And it's just been this morning I didn't hunt, which was kind of like, well, yeah, it's November, whatever. But, you know, it was 60
literally
degrees.
The low was like 60 last night.
Yeah.
So you didn't miss a whole lot. I hunted. And
what did you see?
I saw 2 deer.
Uh-huh.
They were 1.5-year-olds. And they did not care anything about grunting, rattling, or food.
1.5s just cruising around, but just not being anywhere close to you, I guess.
Just lost.
Yeah.
They were really lost. Looking for does. They were just walking.
Yeah. It's weird, man. It's a weird time right now, but it's happening soon across much of the country. And I actually got a pretty good – we shot a deer in Texas, and we're going to do a podcast about that probably in the next couple of days and try to get that out to you later this week, hopefully. And then I've actually got my wife to check some trail camera at my house, and there's some pretty good bucks on it all of a sudden showing up. So I thought it might happen around this time. So things are getting good.
I'm sick. We need to go home.
Yeah. We haven't seen anything in daylight here in Kansas, so let's go to Texas.
Yeah.
No, it's an exciting time coming up in Texas, too. Once we get back, probably recoup for a day or so, and then get back in the woods. And, I mean, it's going to get real good real quick, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty exciting. Anyway, with that, we're going to get Rod on the phone and try to get some tactics for the rest of this month. And hopefully this will lead you guys to some big bucks. And if it does, send us a picture on Instagram or something like that, or in the email on the website or whatever. So anyway, with that, let's get to Rod.
All right, on the phone right now, we've got the only Olympic gold medalist we've ever had, multiple medalist, Rod White with Bucks, Bulls, and Bows podcast, among a lot of other things. He's the ultimate anti-hunter karate chopper. comment the leader that is out there, man. What's going on tonight?
How's it going, guys?
It's going good, man. We are driving down a rural Texas highway and seeing deer run across the highway, which I mean, does happen from time to time always, but you know, you start seeing this frequency of it from every couple miles, you know something's up, you know?
Yeah, for sure. We were just talking a little earlier before you hit the record button there about how I sound silly, but I used to call around areas I hunted, whether I was hunting Illinois or Iowa or Wisconsin, and just call the local police every day and say, just curious, you know, have any deer collisions? And they tell you. I mean, I don't know any reason why they'd lie to you, but I mean, when they start telling me they'd have 7, 8, 9 in a day when they usually have maybe 1 or 2 every other day, then I know that, you know, we're right in the heat of the rut, because you start moving around different parts of the country and the rut does definitely, seems like, especially when you get down south, it gets a little more erratic, but it's definitely delayed a little bit more down south than what it is up north. A lot of the stuff that happens up north happens just a couple of days before we experience it here in Iowa.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then it's weird how you said it's erratic and some places it's so spotty, but that's really a great way to pinpoint it, like you're talking about. And you're actually about to go hit the heart of the rut there in Iowa, right? Aren't you heading on a little bit of a trip here?
Yeah, I live in Iowa City. I moved up there. I bought a mosquito franchise, basically a mosquito control franchise, and I moved up there because my kids were up there too. A lot more population where I was in southeast Iowa, and so now I'm literally running all over Iowa, from northeast Iowa down to southeast Iowa and over by Des Moines and west of there a little bit. Just blanketing public grounds right now. Right now, honestly, I've kind of made the decisions of the areas I'm going to hunt for the most part. But I usually spend October bouncing around if I don't have private lands that I'm hunting specifically where I have a target deer, which they're, believe it or not, it is kind of tough to come across them in Iowa for at least the caliber that I'm looking for. So I spend a lot of time going through public grounds, and my strategy when I'm doing this is to find really good trees and good location with good wind directions and good access, not knowing what's there. But as I'm doing that, I'm also dropping cameras everywhere, and then I pick them all up that third week of October and look for a target buck on any of those cameras, and then I'll focus on those areas. But when I go back to hunt those, I know I'm going into a certain zone of that farm for whatever reason, or that public area. I'll go back into that spot. I already know the tree I'm going to be in. In many cases, I've already kind of pulled some limbs out of the way or tied them back with twine, because you're not supposed to cut down limbs, but prep those areas. So I have areas prepped all over the place, regardless of whether I'm going to have a deer in there or not this year, but maybe in 2 years I will have a deer, and I know that place is already ready to go. I don't set stands all over the place. Everything I go in with everything, and I take everything back out with me.
Yeah, that's smart, man. Can you kind of bet in Iowa that every 3 years or so there'll be a shooter on a property?
No, there's no rhyme or reason to it. I wish you could say that, but one thing we face a lot here is, you know, I have thousands of acres around Mount Pleasant, Iowa, that I've hunted, which is, you know, just north of where Lee and Tiffany's, at least where the home place used to be. They've sold, I think, and moved on to something else. But we got hammered with EHD to the point that it's absolutely not worth hunting. And for a while, I was managing a lot of private lands, up to 10,000 acres in 5 different states. And I kind of got away from hunting my home place there in Mount Pleasant. And I went to go hunt it about 3 years ago, I think it was. And gosh, I hunted 7 days and saw one deer. And I knew all those areas really, really well, obviously. So I was going in the dark. I was setting up, and then I'd set all day long, and then I'd come back out at dark, so I wouldn't see the lack of sign. But finally, after about 7 days of that, I'm like, dude, something's going on. So I climbed down, and other people had permission to hunt some of those areas too. And I climbed down and looked for scrapes and rubs, and they were just non-existent. And it's pretty much still that way. And we've got some year and a half olds and 2.5 year olds starting to come back. But I had stands that we used to call, my brother and I used to call 30 doe, because you couldn't sit in them without seeing 30 does. And now you can sit in that stand for 30 days and not see a deer.
It's just, oh my gosh.
It's hard to fathom, but it's super hyper local. Like, I can go down the road 6 miles, which unfortunately I don't have permission, and there's deer everywhere.
Yeah.
But they just don't, you know, people say they just bounce right back, and they not 6 year olds. Oddly enough, it takes 6 years to grow a 6 year old deer.
So, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, you can argue with me all you want, but I'm pretty sure that's a solid fact.
Yeah, you know, you can't argue with hard facts, man. Facts don't care about your feelings. So, you know, yeah, Tyler actually drew Iowa last year, you know, and we were talking to you quite a bit about stuff, and you kind of were the bearer of bad news. Nothing against you, but, you know, you kind of were one of the first ones to really kind of give us the lowdown on the HD. And we saw a few deer, you know, it wasn't terrible, but we found a deadhead that was a slick 10, you know, 150 type deer, which for us was definitely a deer that, well, I won't speak for Tyler. That was a deer that you probably would have shot, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's a good deer wherever you're from.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of sad to find that head because we actually found it in the dark walking in, and we're planning on doing a hanging hunt in a tree that we had just map scouted and found right there. And you just know that, like, you know, we end up sitting up 20 yards from this deadhead, and you're like, man, that's the deer that we should have been trying to set up on here and seeing from the stand, but instead he's dead on the ground, you know, at the at the base of the tree. So, yeah, definitely can kind of see the impacts of that, man. But, you know, you're talking about, you know, having lower deer density numbers, and I'm sure trying to scare people away from Iowa, it sounds like a little bit, but no, it's Iowa's an amazing place. You know, I hope to hunt it the next year too. But you know, it's just, it's hard to draw and the low pressure is nice and all. But one of the things that I really, really love about going up there is, man, the deer lay down sign. And we come from East Texas, where they just don't hardly do that at all. I mean, you find a rub, you kind of like call your buddy and tell him, hey, dude, I found a pretty good rub today. You know, like, it's just a, it's not quite the same. And we hunt, you know, in a couple other states around the Midwest too, and it's, you definitely see more sign. But one of the things we learned, we went on a scouting trip in Iowa in 2017, and man, by mid-February, it's like there's so much sign that you can't even hardly differentiate between what you should be looking at, you know. And that's really what we wanted to kind of talk to you about, because you're real good at going in and finding the right place, the right location to target big bucks, and you've already kind of told us your trail camera strategy. But you know, for a lot of guys, especially guys who haven't got to hunt so very much this season, they're probably going to try to really concentrate their efforts over the next couple weeks, right? November is magic, and that's what we all love. That's why Tyler and I just saw a buck in the ditch with his head poking out. You know, like, he's they're on fire. And guys that are traveling or going to spend a lot of time hunting, they need to be able to figure out and make good decisions off of the sign they see laid down. So we thought we would get you on to talk a little bit about some sign stuff. And I guess to go kind of broad, man, what gets you fired up when you walk in the woods and see it?
Well, to begin with, I really, so I'm hunting all public land this year with maybe one or two exceptions, but I'm hunting all public land this year. And so, like, for me, and I realize not everybody has the ability to do this or has the time, especially if you don't live here. But I am covering, I have, so now I've got some spots that are in an extreme corner of southeast Iowa. I've got some spots that over by Decatur. I've got a few by Ottumwa, and I've got a few up in northeast Iowa. I know those are scattered all over the place, but, you know, again, I went in there early and I found the trees. But how I find the trees, which you don't necessarily have to put your boots on the ground, but for this time of year, the phase that we're in, we're dealing with bucks that, yeah, they're laying down a ton of scrapes in the morning. And if you can bumble across that activity, which you should be able to fairly regularly if you know how to read your topo map, you can, when you come across that sign, as long as you stay mobile, you can set up on that for the afternoon and probably have a really great hunt, even for the next day or so. But as we come into November 5th, 6th, 7th, especially when we hit the 7th, right about, it's the same every year. I don't care about the moon phase or any of that. It's always been the same year in and year out. It's, I mean, at least in the 30 plus years that I've bow hunted, when you hit that November 7th time frame, give or take a day, everything that you found out prior to that is all thrown out the window. And that's the same way with the rubs and the scrapes, because the behavior you saw earlier that was laying down rubs and scrapes was deer that were hyperlocal and still are for the next few days. They're hyperlocal. They're in their core areas. They're really not going very far. They don't really have to. But when they get, like, we had a really windy weekend this weekend. There was probably some whiffs of estrus from some does that came in a heat here or there and probably got them up on their feet quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But as you move through the next 3 or 4 days, their core areas are going to start to expand considerably, regardless of their age structure. And once that starts happening, your ability to when you find that hot sign and climb in a tree and be successful that night starts to diminish more and more. So when you see activity like scrapes and rubs appear now, you've got to keep in mind that you may be catching the tail end of consistent activity, but those rubs and scrapes may have been partially territorial. But as we progress over the next, you know, 7 to 10 days, the rubs that you're going to see may not be territorial at all. In fact, I would argue probably very few of them are territorial at all. They're more confrontational rubs, I would call them. The rubs where multiple bucks have come together in the same area and started to rub trees. And like you can look, I don't know if I still, I guess it was on my Instagram video from last week, but I know I have some video on there, even on my feed, where I show some, you know, like a 140 buck comes into the antlers and he's got another buck trailing behind him and he's starting to make some rubs right there where he gets to, he's showing off and displaying and being aggressive. But that's not necessarily a rub line per se, like where you may have hunted in the past. That's going to be consistently making that deer appear on that line. They're just not going to be in normal patterns like that. So finding rubs and scrapes, yeah, they're awesome, but the effectiveness of those going forward are going to start to diminish. Now you need to really focus on trying to find big tracks, in my opinion. I don't know if I will or not this week, but if I check out a couple other places, the first thing I do with a piece of public ground is I walk that creek bottom that runs through there. If there is one, I'm looking for big tracks, because big tracks mean mature animals most of the time. Not necessarily tells you what's on their head, but at least I know there's mature animals in there. And then I walk the property borders, and if I find some big rubs coming in and out on the edges of that, I know I'm dealing with at least multiple bucks that are fairly mature, at least 4.5, 3.5 years old. And that's where I'm going to key in first, and then I'll start to break down those areas, find the rubs and scrapes. Almost exclusively, though, after about 3 or 4 days from now, I'm going to start hunting like ravine head funnels in the morning along bedding areas. In our area, we have a lot of honeysuckle. I know that's prevalent in parts of Missouri and in Illinois, too, where you've got real thick vegetation that represents bedding areas for, in general, for deer. Those bucks are going to start swinging around the downwind sides of those, and the same thing with the food areas in the evening. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for that kind of sign to know that they're there, but you're especially looking for big tracks, in my opinion. And then you're starting to look for your bedding areas to hunt in the mornings, and you're looking for your funnels for midday activity. And then in the evenings, the last couple hours, I'm going to bail out of the tree and I'm going to go somewhere along some sort of a food source as we move through this next week. That'll change in another week, but everything's constantly evolving. Unfortunately, there's no, whatever works this week probably isn't going to work next week.
Except for get your butt in a tree, right? So
exactly.
Go ahead.
No, it was funny because I listened to a podcast the other day with Andre in there, and he was talking about, someone had told him a story, or he was referring to something. Andre DeCista was saying something about, you know, a mature buck probably walks by 1,000 trees in a day, and you're telling me you can't find one of them?
Dude.
I'm like, wow, that needs to be on bumper stickers on everybody's truck running around in November.
No kidding, dude. I love when you can just throw down something simple that's so profound like that. It's hilarious. So you gave it like a great, you know, explanation there, but I want to go back to something that you mentioned right at the beginning. And you said if you can read a topo map, you'll be able to find sign. I can read a topo map, and I can find some sign here and there, but I think that depending on where you're at in the country, that's definitely going to mean something different. Can you maybe explain what you're talking about there, you know, like Midwest specific, when you're talking about reading a topo map to be able to find sign, you know, to be able to take that map scouting and convert it to boots on the ground with results?
Sure. So really, some of these features are consistent across the landscape about no matter where you are. But like if you're hunting up in the Peace River of Alberta or the Bozeman up there, you know, you're hunting a lot flatter ground than you're probably dealing with up here. But there probably is some topography in and out of there in certain places. Well, I know there is because I've hunted up there. Whereas, you know, if you're hunting the Allegheny Mountains out east or down in Virginia or something, you know, you're hunting a lot more forested areas. Food sources kind of play into those. They're easy to find here in the Midwest, but what you're really looking for are, in my opinion, for next week, this week and next week specifically, is you're looking for areas of either vegetation or a combination of vegetation and elevation changes that force whitetails to move up over top of a ravine head, or where the source of the ravine head is. I call them ravine head funnels. I think a lot of people do.
I think we call them creek horns. Maybe we're talking about the same thing there, right? Like kind of where the drainage kind of peters out at the top. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like where the drainage would actually start.
Yeah.
In the Midwest here, for the most part, if it's flat at all, it's probably farmed.
Yeah.
Unless you're down in southern Illinois. I mean, it's and so, you know, you can scratch off that area of the landscape as far as, you know, a lot of these crops are being picked right now. And the more crops being picked, the better everything gets. But as those all the corn especially is being picked, you can scratch those areas off as obviously as places you're not going to hunt specifically, but you are going to hunt the little fingers and ditches and drainages that go out there, especially when we move into the post rut. Not to skip ahead, but those ravine head funnels, like in creek crossings, those are right now are they're generally formed by natural either vegetation or by the land contours themselves. So I look at a contour map, and I mean, anymore, I just use Onyx for the most part. I've kind of started playing with base map. I like it. It seems like it has better maps on it, almost depending on what area you're in. But when you see those contour lines getting really, really tight and making a sharp curve, that's generally an indication of where one of those ravine head funnel types might be up at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, if you're kind of hunting some river bottom stuff, where you see three or four long ridges kind of coming down together and meeting in one place, that's a place you're going to find a bunch of scrapes. If it's a pretty calm day and you've got, you know, a sunny day warming up the earth and your thermals are coming up, you can absolutely hunt those. And I've done very well on them. You know, versus if you're trying to hunt those first thing in the morning or late in the evening, unless you've got some prevailing winds working in your favor, that's a little tougher. But those are places where you'll usually find a lot of scrapes and rubs too. Again, the more stretch rubs that you see, the more likely those are confrontational rubs, meaning that those are places where bucks have met other bucks, or you got somebody like me that rattled in several bucks that came together and are displaying for each other.
Yeah.
When that happens, that's not necessarily a sign that I'm super keyed in. I was like, oh, that's the only place I want to hunt. Especially as we progress into the rut, I can't imagine leaving areas like that where I have really good sign, because a lot of those creek corridors are going to be extremely important to catching deer that are moving out of their areas and maybe passing through your areas, even some of your local deer here and there. So I don't want to miss an opportunity at those. And for me, in a lot of cases, I will hunt those midday rather than first thing in the morning or late in the evening, because the thermals will, especially on a slow wind kind of a day, like a wind where you have like a 2 to 4 mile an hour wind, maybe at most, your thermals can overtake that quite a bit, and your thermals will keep you clean down in there and hunt. So when I come across a situation like that along a creek corridor where there's a lot of sign of deer moving back and forth alongside that creek and then dropping off the ridges, and where I can see where those cuts are down in the banks where those deer are piling in and out of there, especially if I see a good track in there, I'm going to find a way to hunt that. And the best way for me to hunt that, besides midday on a slow wind day, is also look however it is that wherever I can place myself that I can get an arrow into that area where all that sign is from another location. I might be 20 or 30 yards away from there, and maybe even on the other side of the creek, but somehow where I can deliver an arrow into that area and keep my wind clean, because those kind of areas are extremely important as we move into the next couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned that in the evenings you would be hunting more of a food source. Can you talk about what a setup typically looks like for you hunting a food source and also hunting mature bucks? You know, those two things don't always go hand in hand.
They virtually never go hand in hand here in Iowa, unless you have a situation where you're managing large tracts of ground and no one else has access to them, and you're pouring the food to them. Most of the hunts, not knocking anybody by any means, but most of the hunts you're watching on TV or people hunting in Iowa, like the Kiskeys and Lukoskis, I know those folks are good people, but they're hunting situations that the average person doesn't hunt in.
Right.
You're not hunting, I mean, especially if you're hunting public land like a lot of us are right now, you just don't control those variables that are there whenever, or not there whenever, you have exclusive access or control over those. So what I have found is I will generally set up downwind of food sources in the evening, because typically bucks aren't very concerned right now with eating as much as they are finding does. Mm-hmm. And if you can get 20 to 30 yards into the timber rather than being on the edge of the field, for me anyways, I've been way more productive at airing mature whitetails, specifically bucks that are skirting those edges. A lot of times you'll see fingers of trails that are going into a food source, so whether that's, you know, a cut corn or a bean field or whatever the case may be, that are going directly into there from the heavy cover. But what I see a lot more behavior of, and where I've killed a lot of my better deer, especially in the evenings during this time period, are where those bucks are going downwind of those food sources where they can cut across all those trails. So they're using a lot less effort to find does that are possibly coming into heat, and they'd rather be on the inside of that timber than what they would actually outside in the open field. Not to say you can't see that, but, you know, again, in certain situations where you have private ground, nobody else has access to it, and those deer feel extremely secure, you may have one of those giants walk out in that food plot or in that standing cornfield, whatever the case may be. But in my experience, under any kind of pressured ground or whether you're sharing private ground with other people, those bucks would rather swing around downwind and hit that edge of that field, scent check it, and then move on to the next place they're headed to.
Gotcha.
So I'd rather be 20 to 30 yards inside of that edge, inside the timber.
Yeah. So you said that, you know, bucks are more concerned with those, and I 100% agree. If you're going in, you know, blind and boot scouting your way in and looking for, you know, fresh sign or whatever to set up on, say that right now it sounds like it's a good idea to concentrate on does. What's a good way to determine that there's a high density of does in an area? I mean, they don't lay down sign like bucks do, per se. Can you just look at a map and say, okay, that's a thicket, there's going to be does there, or is it more complex than that?
It's a little more boots on the ground than what it is just looking at the map, because the map generally isn't going to show you the vegetation unless you're really using a lot of map sources like Gaia, or you're using, you know, like Google Earth and going back in time through imagery to see where some food sources are. Like some of those will have some thermal images in the maps that'll show you some oak trees and things if you look at the historic past of it. And yeah, you can get a good handle on, you know, like there's acorns everywhere right now, all over the Midwest from what I've seen. Everywhere I go, there's acorns. So it's not as valuable of a food source, but still, if you can find like where some of those oaks drop down off those ridges and there's already a food source there, those does are concerned about food. The bucks aren't. Mm-hmm. So wherever the does are, where you're going to find your bucks, basically kind of ripping through those areas, they're not going to stay there very long. A lot of times, if you see them go out in the field, they'll bump those does and they'll move off and go to the next one. They'll spend a few minutes with them, and that's about it.
Yeah.
As we get later, they'll start really running them pretty hard, and that's when you start seeing a real change in behavior where mature bucks are actually pushing does out into weird areas that you wouldn't normally hunt, like long fingers of timber that run out into big CRP tracks or fence row type situations. They're going to start pushing them away from the other deer, just like a guy at a bar. Get a hot girl, you start talking to the bar, you don't want to be hanging around all the other guys talking to her very long. You want to get her the heck out of there.
Yeah.
It's the same situation. Get her away from all the other pressure.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing as well. Especially the older they get, you see that behavior become more and more prevalent.
Yeah, for sure. You find the food and you find the bedding relating to that, and then you find these trails that are going into the food, and you're going to get set up for an evening hunt. You want to back off the edge of the field there so that you're hopefully on a buck trail. Are you able to find the buck trail? Is it super faint, or is there some other kind of landscape feature or terrain feature that you're able to just know that a buck is going to be 20 to 30 yards typically from that edge? Or, you know, is there actually like a perpendicular trail that you can see that the bucks usually use?
Well, that's a really good point. I guess I didn't finish. Yeah. I'm set up 20 to 30 yards inside, but you'll see a lot of times you'll see a very faint trail start about this time of year, starting to form alongside that about 10 to 15 yards inside the timber from the field edge.
Okay.
So I'm trying to kill that deer that's just inside the timber, not so much 20 to 30 yards inside moving through there. Does that make sense? I'm set up 30 yards, 20 to 30 yards inside the timber, expecting to shoot that deer between there and the field edge.
You know what
the
I love?
The other thing that at this... So what's that?
You know what I love is that you're an Olympic archer and you're still trying to set up for 20 and 15 yard shots, man. That's what I'm talking about. that's killing shots, dude. That's good stuff.
I like getting close, man. I don't know. That's bow hunting. Otherwise, I guess I'd gun hunt.
Yeah, man, it's
for
fun.
Sure.
But one thing I'd say too, that especially here in the Midwest, and it really depends on the areas you're hunting. Obviously, the further south you get, it seems like you get less of a response to antlers, especially when your buck to doe populations kind of start to get out of whack. But I have every bit of confidence in the world, and I don't get anything from the Deer Society guys and illusion game calls. I don't want anybody to think that, because I don't. But I can 100% guarantee that. Well, I should say 99.9, because I'll just ruin it for myself.
That's it. No absolutes, dude. There's no absolutes in this world.
There are no absolutes. Always and nevers. Forget those outlets.
Yeah, that's right.
Equation. But I feel like with an extremely high degree of confidence that I can call any mature buck that walks out into a field into that timber with me. What I can't do is be on the edge of a field and call a buck from the timber out to that field.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a very different scenario that I have struggled a lot to pull off.
I love that.
If it's a CRP field with a bunch of cover that's over top of their head, that's a little different story. Mm-hmm. I can be out in a long stretch of timber at the end of a point where I've done really well out in the past, especially as you get towards the post rut. I can call deer out to there, but I cannot seem to call them into a wide open food source like a cut cornfield or a food plot or a cut or even a standing bean field. It's very, very difficult to convince them to come out there.
Yeah.
Versus if they're out in the field, for me to call them in, I feel extremely strongly, just historically, I don't have any problem pulling a buck in at all.
Are you using buck sounds strictly, or are you using a combination of buck and doe sounds, or what's that sound like?
So this changes again, like as we move through, but right now, antlers are more important than anything else. As far as that's the first thing I hit them with.
Uh-huh.
And I've had some questions people ask me about, like, how do you rattle, or how long, how often, how hard, blah, blah, blah. Well, so I start out to basically, it's more important to twist and pop those antlers together than what it is smash them together. Like, I see a lot of guys doing that where they're holding it, whether it's synthetic or real, they're holding those antlers on each side and they're smashing them together. Well, I mean, whitetails aren't bighorn sheep. I mean, they're not backing up and then running at each other. You know, when they start going out, it's usually a clicking or a popping or a tickling kind of thing that you kind of hear. So I'll do that for about 30 seconds initially if I'm blind rattling, which I do a little bit of now, more so next week. But I'll do a little bit of blind rattling right now. And when I'm doing that, I'll do that for about 30 seconds, because if I don't and I just go straight into rattling for a little while and aggressively, there's a good chance I'm going to screw up and have a buck slide in on me and so fast that I can't put the antlers down and grab my bow. Because it just happened to a buddy of mine that was hunting with me too. And he was literally like 200 yards away from me. And there was a deer. He couldn't see 35 yards from him. He grabbed the antlers, started rattling. That deer was on top of him so fast he couldn't put the antlers down. It was like a mid-130s, something he wasn't going to shoot.
Yeah.
But still, it was there that fast. Had that been a really good target buck of his or something, or a buck he wanted to shoot, yikes. There's no way he couldn't have shot it. So yeah. I'll generally do that first, and then I'll get more aggressive, and I'll try to get that sound to carry a lot further. And, yeah, I'll kind of pull him apart and hit him a little bit further because I want that sound to travel a long ways if nothing immediately responds. But if I see a deer that's out in the field and I want to call him to me, I'll kind of basically be on the same program as the first part. I'll just tickling them is such a weird word because I just don't see deer do that. Like, yeah. They're fighting enough. I'll put them, like, if I'm in a stand, if I'm in a saddle, it's great because I can have those between me and the tree, and that deer's not going to see them. And I start twisting and grinding and popping them a little bit. And when I see his head pick up and look at me, I'll just keep him entertained for about 10 seconds and then stop. And man, the odds of that deer coming to me are so ridiculously high. It's near 100%. And as long as they don't see you move, that's kind of another reason why, you know, the saddle gig's kind of been a little more, for me anyways, I lean towards it a little bit more because I can move around that tree however I want and keep the tree between me and him. But I've also done it out of a stand quite a bit too, quite frankly, sitting in the stand facing the deer and just twisting them, popping them with my antlers kind of down between my knees. It's just a little trickier when he decides he's going to come in, getting those dang things hung up and getting your bow in your hand at the same time. Mm-hmm. But I haven't hunted for a saddle for a long time until last year. So I've dealt with it and made it happen. So
you feel like you can straight up rattle in between your knees while a deer is looking at you and he won't see you.
Okay. Well, let me define that a little bit.
Okay.
If I'm in the timber 20 or 30 yards and I've got cover between me and him, then yes. Now if I was on the edge of a field, another example, if I was on the edge of the field and the deer is 60 yards away, he's going to look right at you. You're done. There's no way.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if he's out in the field 40 or 50 yards and you've got cover between you and him, one of the things I say all the time is, hey, if you can see their eyes, they can see you most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wait till they've got their head behind a tree or something. And that might be a tree that's right in front of you whatever, just a little bit of cover. And then you'll see them pick their head up and they're looking in your direction. And as soon as you see them start coming, stop. Because there's no more reason to rattle after that. And in fact, honestly, once you see him recognize it, there's really no more reason to rattle again anyways. He's either going to come in or he's not. The louder you get or the more aggressive you get is not going to change his mind. He's either going to be curious or he's not, and he's going to go on about his day after that.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah, man, that's freaking cool. You know, sometimes it's always good for us to have, like, just questions ready, but then you go to talking about this stuff, and I get so hyped that I just kind of start daydreaming about that scenario actually playing out, you know. So, you know, continuing on the rattling thing, you said a little something about it being different in the South, or the further south you go. Like, how would you adjust that if you're talking about going to a place that maybe has a worse doe-to-buck ratio, or maybe just a place with a higher or lower deer density? What difference does that make there?
Well, I think one of the things that's probably more important than that factor is the maturity of the deer that are in the area.
Yeah.
More so than even the doe-to-buck ratio, but it does seem like if you have very few bucks to an enormous amount of does, it does seem a little more difficult to get them to respond to those. At the same time, I don't know, other than, you know, you can throw out a simple contact grunt, and by that mean I just a grunt to see what kind of reaction you have. The problem with the grunts right now are, and I'm not saying you can't grunt in deer in by any means, but you're probably not hearing a lot of that in the timber yourself, whereas you get to November 7th, 8th, 9th, you start hearing them chasing does, you'll start hearing a lot more of that.
Yeah.
But right now, if you know, there's a whole library of stuff you can look up with the Deer Society of videos that I've done with the different types of grunts, and they're all things that I've heard in the wild myself and I've been able to capitalize on with, but it's just grunts right now generally don't seem to elicit a reaction that's super positive. It's not negative either, but they just don't seem to really have a whole lot of attention they pay to it. And I'm not really sure why, but the further south you go, or when you get to those places where you have less mature deer, or you have a lot of does per bucks, where your ratios are kind of a little bit out of whack compared to what they are here in the Midwest, you just won't get that type of response. So in that scenario, you know, let's say you've got a lot of 2.5-year-old deer, maybe on the high end, but you have 1 4.5-year-old deer hunting, I mean, he's probably not going to respond to your calls. So in that scenario, I don't have any advice other than, I don't know, like, try again tomorrow.
Yeah. Are you better off just trying it and see if it works, or is it better to just sit down, shut up, and hope he comes your way?
I think at this time of the year, you're better off trying. Throw something at him. I'm not to the point now. Like, later in the season, if you ask me 2 weeks from now, if I see a giant buck and he doesn't respond to antlers or to calls, what am I going to do? I'm going to climb down on the tree and I'm going to go try to get an arrow in him. Because more than likely, I'm never going to see that deer again. My experience is after I hit November 14th till about Thanksgiving, those bucks that I see, for the most part, are not local deer. Especially if I see a deer I've never seen before of an upper age class structure. If I can, I'm going to climb out of my tree and get as close as I can. And, you know, hopefully, obviously still on public land if I'm hunting public or on the piece I have permission on, and try to get an arrow in them. More than likely, they're probably following a doe at that time period, and they're trying to push the doe out away from the rest of the deer. And if you're lucky enough that they kind of corner themselves into a timber lot somewhere, you might be able to walk right up on them and kill them. I've done it before, and I know other people that have too. I mean, it's not the ideal situation, obviously, but that's, you know, again, that's later in the season post-rut activity.
Yeah, sure. And you're talking about that post-rut a little bit. Let's push that way just a little bit, just dip our toe in. But say that, you know, the early part of November didn't go as planned for you, and you still have a tag to fill, which is probably a lot of guys, right, and myself included last year. Back to kind of the sign thing that we first started talking about, if you see, like, a new rub open up or a new scrape open up in that, you know, lockdown phase or whatever, you know, after the 14th or so, can you assume that then you have another local deer and there's a deer, you know, that is his core area again at that point in time, and you should be hunting that fresh sign again?
No. I pay zero attention to it after that.
Really?
And that comes from me also running cameras on that stuff.
Yeah.
Even if I killed a deer tomorrow, I'm still going to be out doing what I'm doing now anyways. I might try to go get a tag in another state if I can. But even if I can't, I'm still doing what I'm doing now. Like, a couple people watched the videos and stuff that I popped on my Instagram the other day, And there were some nice deer. I had 140, 150 inch deer that came, you know, right in front of me. And people were screaming, man, how come you couldn't, why didn't you shoot that deer? I'd shoot that deer. And you get the whole, everything from that to, you know, you can't eat the horns, blah, blah, blah story. But
yeah.
You know, and I usually, when I respond with this, it shuts them up for the most part. I just say, if I killed it, I wouldn't learn nothing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't learn anything. Mm-hmm. So even if I tagged out now, I'd still be doing that later. And that's where some of that experience is coming from. What I'm telling you, I've sat in a tree a lot without a tag. I've got no bow or nothing. Mm. Sometimes with a camera, sometimes not. Just trying to learn more.
That's a good opportunity to cry. You know.
Well, I tell you what, it's a good opportunity to understand too how to call in deer and how to communicate with deer if you've never done it before.
Yeah.
Because now you have no risk. I mean, what do you got to lose? Like, call it the thing. Try to throw a fawn bleed out it. And maybe you'll start to learn a more. I encourage people to carry cameras because you're going to learn way more about deer behavior than what you would have if you just quit, because you aren't going to learn nothing sitting at home.
Yeah.
But if you can film those deer, like on a tree arm or something, and you experiment with different types of calls and then go back home and watch that reaction, because when you're watching it at home on tape is way different than when you're actually in the moment, because it's exciting. Yeah. Even if you're not going to kill a deer, it's exciting to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
But you can watch that behavior, and man, that's what I really try to get across, at least in the podcast I do, not just yours but anyone I do for my own, is I'm trying to educate people on, listen, the real value of your deer season is going to come in understanding whitetail behavior specifically, because it's going to help you capitalize later on, not just in arrowing of the biggest deer of your life, because quite frankly it really doesn't help you learn much. It's super cool, but you're not going to learn anything. Mm-hmm. And if you're not progressing, you're not learning, man, I don't know. Well, I guess you're probably not listening to this podcast anyways.
We're entertainment value strictly. Nobody learns anything here.
So you guys are doing good this season, especially.
Okay, so then let's say we're in that middle November area, like you're talking about. What is there any particular type of sign that you're paying any attention to at all, or how are you picking your spots when you go out to hunt?
So when I get to that time period, I am changing up quite a bit the areas I'm hunting. I'm starting to hunt areas that I would never hunt at any other time in the year, and everybody would look at you goofy as far as where you were going to hunt. I'm hunting a lot of little pieces of cover that run way out into CRP fields. I'm hunting fence rows with no cover around them. I'm generally completely out of the timber at that point. And I'm killing most of my deer in the middle of the day at that point too.
Mm-hmm.
Especially post rut, it seems like I kill a large, vast majority of my mature bucks in the middle of the day. Until we hit about, at least in our area, until we hit about Thanksgiving. Like I said, down in Kansas, the week after Thanksgiving, man, I've never rattled in so many deer in my whole life is what I do down there. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you're at in the country. But for us, the post rut, about the main rut hits about the 7th through the 10th, give or take a day. And then you've got from about the 10th to the 14th, which is what we generally refer to as the lockdown period, which is really when the bucks are physically breeding the does. That chase that's happening, a lot of people call it peak rut. I wish we could rename that as a bull hunting society, because that peak rut really isn't when the breeding is, the majority of it isn't really occurring, but they are coming in the heat, and that's why there's so much chase activity. Then the breeding portion starts from the 10th to the 14th. That's our lockdown period where it's hard to find a deer, because for the most part, they're breeding and they're not going anywhere. But after that, then you start seeing the really mature bucks kick up their activity level. The problem is, for a lot of people, they get discouraged because general deer movement slows dramatically. It just goes way down. But those big mature bucks, because that activity slowed down, start to get on their feet and start looking for more tail. It's very similar to turkeys in that, and that's why midday activity works really well for a lot of people if they stick with it and hunt in the midday. After you get into that rut phase, we really hit the rut pretty hard, because those does will start to lay down, especially post-rut. They'll lay down at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, and those bucks are still looking for tail. And they're going to travel long distances to find it, and that's when they'll make big mistakes. Or they get one that is in season, and they push her out into one of those areas that you wouldn't normally think to look.
Mm-hmm.
Those areas are places that I find in the late, like post-season. Like, I won't search out more of those areas until I get way after the season's over. And I'll find like those little fence rows where you'll come across bunches of smaller trees all rubbed to living daylights, or you'll find like the tip of a piece of timber that goes out in a CRP field with a bunch of rubs in it that you would never think of hunting at any other point in time. That's typically done for me witnessing it in the post rut when a buck has a doe in those areas and he's not going very far at all, like literally getting up, moving around a 50-60 yard area, and he's rubbing up a lot of those areas and scraping them all up while that doe's there present with him.
Why is he just thrashing trees in front of a doe? Like, surely it's not to impress her.
It's an aggression thing.
Okay.
No, he just wants to get laid, and she's maybe not quite cooperating.
Like, yeah.
That's basically it. You know, it's a frustration thing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I saw a buck last year do something similar. It wasn't rubbing on trees, but, you know, one of the bigger bucks I saw in Kansas, he was, you know, really pretty locked down with this doe, and he was following her to bed, and we stalked them later in their beds, but... like, she wasn't doing what he wanted her to do, so he just took off running at her and made a noise I've never heard a deer. It's like he was growling. He's, rah, you know, and, like, almost gored her to get her to move. He didn't want to stay there, you know, and it's just like, man, those things are hyped up that time of year. It's like, if I'd have been standing there, he'd have smoked me, you know?
and that's where that long, drawn-out breeding grunt that I know they've showed on some of the Deer Society stuff where and I had a buck named Croaker that did that. He was a super aggressive deer towards other deer, but it was a long, it'll last 7 to 8, 10 seconds. And the first time I watched it, I was in one of those little tiny, I found a bunch of those rubs, and it was I think 2 or 3 days before Thanksgiving. So well into the post rut. And I found it was a big CRP field, this one little stretch of timber. I was walking out and I just happened to walk across it. That point, it was all rubbed to living daylight. So I'm like, oh, what the hell did I got to lose? I'm not into anything anyways. Tomorrow I'm going to come up there. It was one tree I could get in. It was about 4 inches around. And I climbed up in it, and I sat there. And I think about an hour after light, I was like, I'm a moron. This is dumb.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one.
I'm here for. And I started to pack up my stuff, and I look, and here comes a doe. And about a 160 class 7 or 8 year old buck came in right behind her and was coming right to that point. And I'm like, it wasn't something I wanted to kill, but I was like, what? That's kind of cool. And she came in and laid down in that point of that finger. And he came in basically doing exactly what you described, was really getting aggressive with nudging her. And she bumped off. Well, then he stood there, and that's the first time I heard it. He let out one of those long drawn out grunts, just a big, and it went on for 8 to 10 seconds. And then he even had some clicking that happened at the end of that. And I'm like, that's the freaking weirdest. And unfortunately, I didn't have a camera with me at the time. I'm like, that's the weirdest thing I ever saw. And then I saw the most miraculous thing I ever, which has led to the death of a ton of deer that I've killed. Then I watched a doe come from a different direction in that CRP, come in there, and I watched him breed her. And then she left. And then he laid down for about 15 minutes, and then he got back up and he did it again. And a doe came in from the direction the other one came off of and came in there, and he bred her, and she left again. And I was like, come on.
It's all on demand.
Yes, it was deer porn. Like, I watched it for almost 4 hours.
Golly.
And I was like, wow, like, I need to start making that noise. So I did.
At
and
the bar.
It started working. But in those kind of environments, especially in a CRP environment that had some heavy brush around it, where that finger timber comes out and it's kind of in a depression, like, I'll look for those on maps now. And post rut, I'll find those places. And if there's any kind of rubs in there or scrapes at all, I'll absolutely hunt those way before I hunt any other choke points or timber points or funnels or anything else at that time of year.
So how many sits do you have on something like that where you just see nothing?
A lot.
Yeah.
I will say, though, at that time of year, you do see more deer than what you would if you were sitting there this week or next week, for example. I think a lot of deer probably still on food sources, especially the does. But later, when the breeding becomes extremely important and the pressure is applied from other people hunting other areas, especially on public grounds, actually, I've done really well later in the season, those wide open CRP, I shouldn't say wide open, but big open CRP fields. They have quite a bit of brush and cover in them. Place that you walk around, you find a lot of beds in them. If there's a little point of timber that goes out in there, boy, And if you think about it, like, I've never seen anybody else hunt in that kind of an environment ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll set up in there on a nice, cool morning when it's super frosty and you can hear forever, mm-hmm. and just let those big, long, mature buck runs, just let them go, and then just hang out. And, man, I've seen probably, well, I tell everybody this, the largest quantity of mature bucks that I've shot, the majority of them are shot in that post-rut time period between November 14th to Thanksgiving. Mm. And they're generally shot in that kind of an environment.
That's freaking spooky, dude. Yeah. What that is. That's cool.
How many does are you calling in when you do that?
Several.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's not uncommon at all to see a lot of them come in.
Yeah.
Not like in pairs or anything like that. So when you hit that rut too, the other thing you'll notice, like a big sign of that rut starting, besides calling the police office to find out how many cars that deer getting hit by cars, you'll see a lot of single does start appearing. When you start seeing those single does appearing and those button bucks by themselves, that's a good sign that breeding has begun, or those does are coming to estrus.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what you'll continue to see through the end of that. You'll see those single does by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man, that's cool. You know, you talked about, like, some unique things that you do on public land, like talking about hunting those fence rows and those little fingers that nobody else hunts. Sounds super effective. And one of the things with public land, even in Iowa, where you don't have quite the same pressure, you still have pressure, right? And pressure is relative.
Yeah.
You're always trying to find an edge and find something new and different that no one else is doing, and a lot of times that's how you find deer. What about in the calling game? You know, everyone knows to, like you said, just rattle or tinkle the antlers or rattle antlers, you know, and everybody knows how to make grunt calls. But, like, what are some of the things, or at least maybe one thing, sound-wise, that you can do that no one else really ever does?
Well, I hear people rattle, but they usually sound pretty bad.
Yeah.
And it's usually because they're most of the time, like just watching people from a distance do it, is typically they're smashing those together like they're two bighorn sheep going at each other.
Yeah.
So that twist and that popping is a lot more realistic. I'm not so sure at this time of the year, though, too, that if a deer hears anything that remotely sounds like, I've been climbing up trees with a climber before when I used climbers all the time and had bucks come running into me climbing the tree.
Yeah.
So I'm not so sure that they're even, I think we give deer way too much credit for their thought process. I don't think they have thought process like we think they do, or we would like to think they do. A lot of times they're just reacting.
Yeah.
And especially that time of the year, they're fired up. They're all toned up, and when they hear, you know, antlers anywhere, like, oh, there must be bucks over there, and pff, they come running over. There's not like a whole lot of thought process that goes into it, so I don't think they're trying to decipher what it sounds like. But I do think they can recognize, especially in a highly pressured area, you know, somebody smashing antlers together like that, especially if they've come into them and gotten shot at or had a bad experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the guys that smoke. Like, I would not want to be around somebody that smokes especially on a public ground area, because the odds of a deer having had a bad experience with somebody that does smoke is fairly high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think deer recognize, like, smoking, for example, as a bad thing. You hear guys all the time, well, I spit out of my stand all the time, or I piss in a scrape and that doesn't matter. Well, I don't know how many deer watched a guy pee in a scrape and then walked up to it and smelled him, like, oh, that's from that guy. I'm not doing that again. Like, they can't, I don't think, unless they've had a bad experience from something, I don't think they're going to be super leery of it. But when you're talking about public lands and a lot of people rallying and sound, especially when you got the same guy going to the same tree stand all the time, smashing his antlers the same way together all the time,
mm-hmm.
they probably do get somewhat conditioned to that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got to do, especially on public ground, you got to do things a little bit. I hunted some private ground, or used to hunt some private ground where a lot of other people hunt, and it was worse than public ground almost at times. And just doing something different than, like, for example, I like to hunt zones more than I like to hunt trails, especially on public grounds, because when you're walking a lot of public grounds, it's funny, in Iowa, you'll find some public pieces you'll walk, you'll see tree stands everywhere, and other ones you won't see any tree stands for whatever reason. They're closer to a metropolitan area or whatever. They're popular. When you find a lot of trails that come together, you typically almost always, on public land, you almost always find a tree stand there. You know, even over in Illinois and Missouri, you'll find a tree stand there. So I start doing more. I look more for, like, zones or areas where I feel like depending on the time of the year we're in, like if we're right in the rut where bucks are pushing does away from other competitors or other hunters, they're in areas where there is some bedding cover there, but there's not normally sign there the rest of the year. That's the kind of stuff I hunt a lot more because other people don't. And it seems like I get a lot more success out of getting into bow range, even without calling, just getting away from those guys 40 or 50 yards. Mm-hmm. And I watch those deer walk around their stands all the time. I mean, all the time. Like, one of the greatest tools that you can do is take – it's like there's an Onyx on Onyx Maps. There's a feature where you can put in all the roadless areas.
Yeah.
And that's how, like, you'll hear Randy Newberg and some of these other guys talk about, turn on the roadless map feature and look for those areas that are furthest away from roads because that's where you're going to be furthest away from people. Well, so if you took that same approach and grabbed your, you know, a map of that hunting area that you have and printed it off – or you mark them all, which is the easiest thing to do on my phone. I just mark off everybody's tree stands. And then when I mark those tree stands off, I also walk those trails. Like, once I have an area I know I'm going to be hunting for sure, and I scour that whole thing. I usually take one day, and I'll walk the whole thing. If I've never been to it before and all of a sudden I want to hunt that, say it's not an area I had pre-scouted, I'll mark everybody's tree stand locations. And then I look at all the parking areas, and 90% of the time, people take the easiest routes to their tree stands, and I'll draw a line to that. And similar to what those roadless area feature does on the Onyx maps, I can look at that and go, wow, here's some pockets that nobody probably is in. Here's an area over here where there's no stands and there's no hiking trails that go around it, no horse trails. That's probably a pretty good area where a deer can get away from people. And those are where I find success on public land a lot, especially going into the rut.
Mm-hmm. Are you ever going out just to scout where hunter pressure is, that being boot tracks, tire tracks in the road, some of the pull-in areas and seeing how fresh that is and things like that?
No, but what I do is I put cameras on all the parking areas, and that gets me a really good idea. People are really habitual.
Yep.
So I use cameras a lot at parking areas because if I get a good idea of when, like if I know a guy's always there, I'm probably not going to hunt that particular property. I'll go to another public property somewhere. So I always have backups for stuff. If I don't have at least two or three really good sets on a piece of public ground, I usually will ignore it, especially if it's a long ways from the next piece of public ground, because if you go in there and somebody's already hanging a stand somewhere where you're going, you just don't know. Anybody can be anywhere. Then it's awful nice to be able to go over to another spot or two somewhere away from them where you're obviously going to not be bothering them. They're not going to be bothering you. Most people don't think like that. I've watched it.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just kind of courtesy. I mean, like if I'm running late to a stand, like an hour late, I won't go into a parking area and park where there's four other trucks and go into my stand because I don't want to ruin their hunt. I mean, I get it. I know that most people aren't thinking like that, but for me, it's just something I just feel like it's etiquette that you avoid. So
yeah,
for sure. So, dude, there's always something. Multiple things I learned when we have you on, which we've had you on twice now. So, but such good information, man. I appreciate you coming on and doing this. I guess, you know, for me, the last question, this one's been burning for pretty much the whole podcast, because you've talked about, you know, I saw the story video you posted on Instagram where you passed the 140 or whatever it is. I saw
also
that.
Passed old Crooked Face too, man.
Yeah.
The crazy little buck.
Yeah. So you and then you just talked about like a 160 coming in that you didn't really want to shoot, and I'm just wondering, what are you trying to shoot this year?
I'm really, if I can find a 180, I'll cut an arrow loose on it. I've got 11 booners and two over 200. So for me, I don't, that's just the caliber of deer that I'm after. If I don't kill one, it's not a big deal. Or if I have a really cool hunt for some reason that just, I don't know, it just strikes that I want to shoot that deer for some reason, I'm going to shoot it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, I don't really have, I've got two images now of deer that I'm interested in if I can find them. They're both pushing 190. But I don't know. I've only have one image of each. I mean, all I know is that there's a deer in the area. And that's what I, earlier in the podcast, I was talking about. I'm looking for places that I can find mature the age class structure that I'm looking for. I'm not really looking for one specific deer, but if I know if I've got other 5 and 6 year old deer somewhere, then I know there's probably more than one.
Right.
Especially if there's a lot of 4 year olds. So I'm really looking for a mature buck, period. I don't need to kill another one. If I don't ever kill another one, it's not that big a deal. It's just I enjoy the process. I enjoy learning more every year, and I enjoy helping other people. And that's, honestly, that's where my focus is. So if I get an opportunity to giant, great. But it's probably going to have to be a 5 or 6 year old deer at least before I take my bow off of the thing. I like hunting, and if I kill it, my season's over, and I don't learn anything. I mean, yeah, I can go to a tree afterwards, but I don't know. It's just what I really don't mean to sound arrogant in that by any way, shape, or form. It's just, man, I've got a bunch on the wall. I'd rather see somebody else shoot something, or I'd rather, hope it makes it to the next year to something big. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. That's cool, too. I just enjoy the experience.
Yep. Man, if you'd rather see someone else shoot something, I'm going to draw in probably 2 years. So just tell me where they're at. I'll take that 160. But no, I'm kidding. But,
I told you guys I'd help you last year.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, you're going to talk to Tyler about that. So.
man, sorry. I forgot how much of an expert you were,
Whatever.
Dude, I tell you, one of the things that I've noticed about dudes that really are, perfectionists in this field like you are, is that they have to be, if you want to be a serious whitetail hunter, you have to love the process like you're talking about, because there's a whole lot more process than there is trigger pulls. We do this thing, we live this lifestyle for, all of 15 seconds a season pretty much, like most of the time when you see a big deer, he's in your life for 30 seconds tops. And sometimes it's longer, but for the most part, that's really what it is. And it's kind of crazy, but, I hate to condense it down, but I know that we're headed hunting, you're headed hunting, everybody's hunting right now. What is your plan like for the next 3 days? Besides killing a giant.
I get my son every other weekend, so every day outside of that, except for Tuesday afternoons when I get him, I'm in a tree. I am hunting all day long. Typically right now I'm bouncing from property to property that I know I've got some mature deer. I really kind of got it down about, I don't know, I want to say like 6 properties or so, which gives me multiple wind directions on all those properties. I don't know what kind of pressure I'm going to be facing there. One thing about Iowa that's unique is, there aren't that many non-residents that draw a tag. So the people that you saw last year on certain places, they shouldn't be there again the next year unless they have some kind of governor's tag, which is the case they're probably not hunting public.
Yeah.
So the pressure changes every year other than the locals. I don't know what I'm facing on some of those properties, but I've got a couple bucks I kind of got my eyes on. But again, I've only got, one image of each. That really isn't anything to try to formulate a real plan on. So it really is to go in there, hit those areas, those zones that I don't see other tree stands in that don't have a lot of traffic. This next week, I'll be hunting a lot in the bedding areas in the mornings till late morning, at least, if not till 1 or 2 o'clock. And then about 1 or 2 o'clock, I'll move out closer to a food source.
Yeah.
So that'll be for the next week. And then when we get into November 10th through 14th, when we start to really hit that lockdown time period, I might actually spend a little more time with my boots on the ground looking for a little more fresh sign, bigger tracks in other areas that maybe I haven't seen yet, or just looking for some of the other pressures. I'll run all the cards I have at parking areas so I see how many people are hunting some of those. And after that, I'll hunt the less pressured areas. And when we hit in that post rut, I'll start hunting those weird places we were talking about earlier, where you're hunting a lot of more wide open area. And there's tons of public ground that is really good pheasant hunting that nobody bow hunts because there's pheasant hunters on it. And same thing with waterfowl. Those properties don't get bow hunted at all, and they're phenomenal for rattling in bucks and communicating for whitetails, especially in the post rut. And a lot of those places are what we're talking about earlier, where those bucks can push those does out of the way and get away from other hunters and from other deer.
Yeah, man, sounds good. We need to get down and do a graphic with you of just a November calendar. It sounds like you've got it down like to the day. So that's pretty cool, dude. If somebody wants to hear more from you and just, hear kind of really some tactical breakdown stuff, I understand that your podcast is all about that, right?
Yeah, it is. I'm pretty much, it's not day to day. I've done those before in the past, but I just, man, there's some days where I just don't feel like doing one and I don't have a good signal.
Yeah, I hear you. Just,
you know, you're worn out from hunting all day long, so I don't want to commit to every day, but I've been doing them every day, every other day kind of thing or whatever. And if there's no information to give, there's no sense in doing a podcast, but, I've got a podcast. It's not on iTunes yet. Maybe by the time you guys post this, it'll be posted to iTunes, but it's been submitted, and I guess it takes a couple of weeks. But it's called Bucks, Bulls, and Bows with Rod White. And in the meantime, they can follow me on Instagram, which is at Olympic Bow Hunter, and then on Facebook, Rod White Olympic Bow Hunter. Both of those pages are where I'm posting those podcasts. Well, more so on the Facebook page. I'm posting the podcast on there, and they can listen to it on whatever platform's available at the moment until it hits iTunes, which hopefully will just send me another day or two.
Yeah, awesome, dude. We'll link to that stuff below. That way people can check out more of what you got going on, dude. Otherwise, happy dadgum November, man. This is what we live for. There's only one November a year, and we're here, dude. So I hope you find some great success this week, and I know that sounds like you'll probably stretch it out because I just got the feeling that you really like that 10th through the 14th time frame to kill a biggin', so I imagine you'll get to do you some hunting the next few weeks, right?
For sure. And you guys, best of luck to you. Stay safe, and hope to see you guys knock down some good ones here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, so, thanks, man. We appreciate it. We'll stay in touch. Send us a picture, dude.
All right, sounds good, man. Thanks.
Thank you. Dude, Rod, no matter how many times we talk to him, has got some new crazy experience that is 100% true that happened in the woods to him within like the past year. You know what I mean? There's always something new and strange going on. And the other thing that struck me from this podcast is that guy is living in Iowa, hunting public, private, everything, and he is driving all around the state trying to find giants. And he found some, but they're not around every corner of every tree.
No.
And a lot of times, hunting media makes you think that's the case. There probably is not very many people in Iowa working harder than Rod White to find a big deer right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. And he has put a good challenge in front of himself with the public land thing that he's doing and mm-hmm. trying to find it, you know, whatever, instead of 180 or whatever on public. I mean, that's a tall task. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little different if you can manage 900 acres or 1,500 acres and, you know, leave food up and stuff and not kill deer for several years. It makes a little bit easier. You know?
It's lot harder for one guy, too, when you got 9 or 10.
Oh, yeah. You know. Dude, when you got guys out in the woods, that's the thing that we run into out here, and you know, out here being Kansas, is it's not like people talk about Kansas a lot, but, you know, when you're out in country that's wide open, a lot of figuring out what deer are doing and which properties are holding some shooters is getting eyes on deer. And when there's only two of you, you know, like this morning, you sat where you can't see very much. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in a cedar tree, and you can't see a whole lot out. And so, like, you're not learning a lot if you're not seeing deer, you know, where they need to be. Mm-hmm. And so that's been tough for us as a team of two. We can't come back to camp at night and go, hey, y'all should go over here, and we'll go over there, because we saw all these deer, you know, using this travel route or whatever. It's a little bit harder for sure. So big teams can definitely have that going on. So that's a good reason for you guys to do out-of-state hunts with, like, four or five buddies. Absolutely. In a big camp, you know? Yeah. So,
or just join Team Element and just tell us where all your deer are.
I think that's a great idea, Dan Beeler. Anyway, we appreciate you guys listening. Don't forget, I know we said this at the beginning of the podcast, but now's a good time because the podcast is wrapping up. Go give us a review here on the podcast, on the platform, Apple Podcasts, and make sure you're telling your friends to subscribe on YouTube. Means a lot to us. Last thing, remember, this is your element.
Live in it.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.